guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Dr. Reza Zadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So regarding the life and works of the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat, who was mainly concerned with the Quranic sciences, in our previous discussion we discussed his magnum opus, his masterpiece, that is At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Qur'an. We discussed what topics are included in that. We said that this book consists of 10 volumes, but the last three volumes are each, we can say, published in separate volumes too, two of which are dedicated to the book which we want to discuss today, that is Al-Tafsir wal-Mufassirun, the exegesis of the Holy Quran and its exegetes. So, Dr. Reza Zadeh, it is documented that the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat compiled this book, that is At-Tafsir wal-Mufassirun fi Sawbat al-Ghashib.
Yes.
I think the main title and the full title is this. In an answer or in a rebuttal to a book that was compiled by Muhammad Hussein al-Zahabi from the University of Al-Azhar. What was the exact story, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, the story is not very complicated. You know, that book was written by, as you said, by Muhammad Hussein al-Zahabi in Egypt, in Al-Azhar in Egypt. And because that book, like many other books, had many incorrect and inaccurate information about the beliefs of the Shia scholars regarding the Quran, regarding the commentary of the Quran, and also different, let's say, aspects of the Quranic sciences, Ayatollah Ma'rifat decided to write a book to clarify and explain the true beliefs that we have regarding the Quran. For example, one very common accusation against the Shia scholars and the Shia beliefs, just like distortion of the Quran. And, you know, that is only one of the things that is said against the Shi'i beliefs that is incorrect, mm-hmm. that they say the Shia believes in the distortion of the Quran.
Okay.
So this one and many other topics actually encouraged Ayatollah Ma'rifat to write something scholarly and explain the true beliefs of the Shi'is regarding the Quran. The result was two different sets of books. One is At-Tafsir wal-Mufassirun that we are talking about mm-hmm. today. And actually this book has okay. two volumes.
That's right.
The first volume talks about the definition of tafsir mm-hmm. And also the tafsir in the sense of exoteric interpretation of okay. the Quran. And then also ta'wil that we can translate as exoteric interpretation of the Quran, okay. exoteric commentary of the verses of the Quran, and then different types of tafsir and history of commentary of the Quran
right.
at the time of the Prophet, and then at the time of the companions of the Prophet, mm-hmm. and then later on in the history of Islam, and then the very important issue of the role of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in the commentary of the Quran. He talks about these things.
Right.
And
in volume one.
This is in volume one, right. And also in volume one, he talks about some of the most important and influential commentators of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second volume, he mainly talks about a tafsir al-athari, which means the commentary of the Quran, exegesis of the Quran based on the rivayat al-ahadith, the narrations of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt.
Okay.
Because that is a type of the Quranic exegesis. He talks about it, and also he also talks about the weak hadith that we have in the interpretation of the Quran, the fabricated narrations that we have. That was volume one, and this is volume two.
That's right.
And the two okay. volumes are called At-Tafsir wal-Mufassirun.
That's right.
Fi Thawbat al-Qashib.
That
right. has been written in Arabic.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha.
So, Sayyid Mohsen, you know, we know that the field of tafsir or exegesis of the Holy Quran are done by the people, we can say, during the history, and different schools of thought who are not ma'asum, who are not infallible. So it seems that they've got, they can interpret or write exegesis of the Holy Quran according to their own presuppositions, okay? So how Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat is going to have a neutral, we can say, look at answering the questions of Muhammad Hussein Zahabi in this book? I mean, because Muhammad Hussein Zahabi's, I think, criticism is regarding those type of exegesis of the Holy Quran who were Shiites during the history. And Ayatollah Ma'rifat is going to defend this type of thinking in terms of exegesis of the Holy Quran. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the main question that was opposed was overall the Shi'i interpretation of the Quran. One thing we need to remember, because in your obviously question you raised, like anyone can just interpret according to his own understanding. We have clear verses in the Quran. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu taqullaha wa kunu ma'as sadiqin. All those who believe, be God-fearing and be with the truthful people, which is Ahlul Bayt and the Quran. In the other verses of Quran, Allah says, Fas'alu ahla dhikr. Ask the people who know, know the Quran. Or rasikhuna fil ilm. Those who have full command over the ilm, who have the knowledge, ask them. We cannot interpret Quran without the help of the narrations of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. This is for clear.
Okay.
One of the reasons that he is bringing the, as the, you know, the division that Dr. Reza Zadeh has just mentioned, like in these two volumes, the last two volumes, Ayatollah Ma'rifat has brought the tafasir or the exegesis or the interpretations of the verses by the Prophet, then by the companions, and then by the, you know, tabat-tabi'in, there were tabi'in and tabat-tabi'in.
That's right.
These are two terms, like after the companions, we have those, the next generation after the companions, and the next generation.
Yes.
And then the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. When he talks about the companions, he says the best person, it's according to the Jalaluddin Suyuti as well, that the best interpretation of the Quran and the one who had the most knowledge after the Prophet was Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
That's right.
And after the, him, it was the Abdullah bin Abbas and Abi bin Ka'b. Mm-hmm. So he mentions it, and he votes it. Now, this is a Sunni scholar. Within the Shia, we can say, like, interpretations, it is very necessary to refer to the narrations of the A'imma, of Ahlul Bayt, because they are the teachers, they are the authorities from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And he has to defend this. Why? Because we are not allowed to just interpret Quran on the basis of independent opinion or reasoning, independent reasoning.
That's right.
Why? Because obviously we are not directly linked to the revelation.
Mm-hmm.
We are not linked to the revelation. It was the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt who were linked. That's why we need them. That's the first thing. The second thing which he is mentioning in the book, and that is very important, especially in the second volume, when he's talking about the weak narration and all those things, he is talking about the Isra'iliyat. We have a topic named Isra'iliyat within the exegesis and the Islamic teachings.
And what is it?
Isra'iliyat is basically is a term in which one of the aspects is that when Jews of that time, they became Muslim, obviously they have their own scripts. And they were, because Jews, they were reading their own scripts. When they came to the Quran, they were reading the verses of the Quran. They started to interpret the verses of the Quran according to their previous knowledge that they have from their own books. For example, in the Old Testament and New Testament, or maybe in the Psalms, there is a story about the creation of the earth.
That's right.
It is said that the Allah has first created the pen, and then after that, he created the word. He wrote, basically, he drew the whole word. There is a story over there.
Okay.
In the Quran, we have a chapter, Qalam, in which it starts with Noon wal Qalam.
That's right.
Now, in some of the exegesis, this Isra'iliyat, this kind of interpretation, which was from that, which is not the original source, obviously, this has come, and they interpreted that with the Qalam, Allah means like the pen, and the Noon is the same creation of the word.
Okay.
Whereas this is not the case. This is not the case. And obviously, when Allah is obviously swerving to the noon here. If you look at the like Zamakhshari's tafsir, he says like noon is set to the ink,
mm-hmm.
and the pen is pen.
That's right.
And Allah is swearing to the ink and the pen, not okay. the. He's talking about the ink and the pen, not okay. the creation of the earth mm-hmm. with the pen, which has come like in the Old Testament maybe or the New Testament. So there are many things.
Sorry, this Israiliyat and this look at the Quran has also get into the narrations and riwayat too.
Narrations and riwayat too.
Okay,
yes,
that's right.
Because you know the in the Islam, especially the Medina,
mm-hmm.
was a state where we had the Jews, the Christians, there were the Muslims. Obviously, the Jews and the Christians, they have the old, like you know, we can say like their own sources of the religion. And when they were living together, there are many things which were merged. Unintentionally, there were some reasons where intentionally some hypocrites
uh-huh.
have intentionally, we can say like inserted these things into Islam and
That's
the
right.
interpretation of Quran in order to change, because they couldn't change the actual wording of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another issue.
That's right.
That because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has protected the Quran, so they cannot change the wordings of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
What they can do is change the meaning.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is very important. And when Ayatollah Ma'rifat is writing this book, he is answering Zahabi in this way as well.
Mm-hmm.
That look, in the interpretations, you find these things as well.
Okay.
You cannot just refer like, say, and the whole religion is based on these things,
mm-hmm.
wrong interpretations, or they say things like this.
That's all right. Thank awesome. You very much. So in general, we can say that a tafsir wa mufassirun is concerned with the topic itself. I mean, the scholarly field of exegesis of the Holy Quran and different makateb or schools of thought which helped
yes.
this field of study during the history regarding the answers to the questions that whether these exegesis of the Holy Quran were done in a right manner or not.
Yes.
Is it so?
Yeah, of course. And you know, this type of working is very important, and especially, as I said in the past, in the today's academic way of you know, writing exegesis on the holy texts, it is important. These are the basic and foundational concepts that need to be answered, need to be taken into account before we start making any commentary about the verses.
That's
for
right.
example, before we know what is the commentary, what is exegesis itself in general,
mm-hmm.
and what are the different schools of exegesis, and what are the let's say different types of exegesis, we cannot start just saying something about the commentaries.
That's right. Okay.
So this is very important introductory let's say work before starting any type of commentary.
So this knowledge of the previous generations is also important, okay?
Yes.
That's all right. Thank you much, Dr. Azadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi
You're
for
welcome.
Presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, on IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. For more information on this episode, visit our website, parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad il-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid. Well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be talking about Islamic laws about usury according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before dealing with these questions, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about Islamic laws about usury, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question. If you sell 1 kilo of rice for 2 kilos of wheat, rice for wheat,
yes,
is this transaction valid? Is it okay? Or you would define it as usury?
Well, rice is one thing and wheat is something else. These two commodities are different, essentially different, okay? As long as they are different, usury does not apply. The rules regarding usury will not apply.
But so you considered or equated the wheat with barley.
Barley, of course, according to Sharia and according to Fuqaha, the religious authorities, wheat and barley are of the same category. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you cannot.
They look very much alike.
They of course they look very much alike.
But rice is white.
Rice is something. Rice uh-huh. is rice. You see, is white. You see, wheat is something else. They
yes.
look like.
And usually humans eat it, but
yes,
wheat.
And you cannot compare between uh-huh. between wheat, barley, and rice. Wheat and barley are look very much alike, mm-hmm. of course. And therefore, if you buy 2 kilos of wheat against 3 kilos of barley, it is haram. It is usury and it's forbidden. But if you do the same with rice, it's not haram. And of course, according in the eye of custom and also in the eye of Sharia, these two things are different. But you know, here custom does not have a say. Okay, mm-hmm. and when it comes to wheat and barley, we know that wheat and barley, according to custom, are two different things. You see, mm-hmm. when you go to the rural areas and you go to the farms, you will see that farmers will not consider barley as wheat and wheat as barley. They are two different things. And of course, unfortunately, the farmers, generally speaking, do not have proper and precise knowledge of the Islamic laws about these things. Okay. They generally end up falling into a mistake because of a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding of the religious laws. They commit such mistakes, mm-hmm. exchanging, for example, wheat against barley, and receiving something in addition to the weight object, okay, to the thing sold against, yes, to the thing sold. So such mistakes do happen, and of course, people, because of a lack of knowledge, they make mistakes, and they are not to blame, okay? Because in rural areas especially, people do not have access to religious authorities. They do not have access to the manual of Islamic laws to read, and obviously they have less knowledge as compared to the people living in cities, because they have access to books, to the internet, to the cyberspace, and they can ask their questions very easily.
Yes, but that was actually for the previous time, I guess.
Yeah,
because now we have internet, we have lots of facilities and technology, and usually even in the rural areas, they are equipped with not only the internet and the social networks, but also lots of media channels are broadcast to them, you know.
Yeah, in modern time.
Television, radio channels. There are lots of things, lots of tools and means of getting information. So I don't think they are not to blame.
Yeah. In modern time, you could be right. Things are the means of communication are available everywhere, but you know the farmers are very much preoccupied. Okay, they do not make time to read things. Yes.
But this is their job, and if they want to have a kind of barter transaction, they need to know everything about,
yeah.
like the religious laws about what they do, right?
Yeah, it's very important for a farmer to know that you cannot sell 2 kilos of superior quality of wheat against 3 kilos of inferior quality of the same commodity, you see?
Yes.
It is forbidden, mm-hmm. Regardless of whether the commodity you sell is defective or faultless or in good shape or in bad shape. According to Islamic Sharia, riba is forbidden, and riba means increase, riba means addition. Islam is strictly against riba.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
since you talked about the good or bad quality of something, let me ask you a very, nice question or interesting question regarding the good or bad quality of something. If someone sells 5 grams of superior quality gold,
yes,
for the same amount,
yes,
5 grams of but inferior quality,
yes.
So we have good quality and bad quality here, right?
Yeah.
Gold. And the seller stipulates that the buyer will have to render a service. So as an addition,
yes,
the buyer has to give something extra, all right? To make up for the quality, the poor quality gold that he gave, and in exchange he received the
good quality.
Superior, yes, quality, yes, of gold, all, yeah, right? Is this transaction in order? Is this transaction okay or valid?
Oh, okay.
Or it is called usury?
Yeah, of course, that is also a very good example. It is absolutely forbidden to receive, for example, the example you gave,
mm-hmm,
5 grams of superior gold against 5 grams of inferior quality gold. Like, for example, we have 18 karat gold,
mm-hmm,
and we have 24 karat gold. Okay?
Exactly.
The 24 is
the maximum.
Yeah, it
quality.
Is superior.
Yes.
And it is more expensive in terms of price. Okay. Speaking.
Sure.
Yeah. So no one on the market is going to sell his gold against the 24 karat gold against 18 karat gold, but the Sharia says that these two are homogeneous. These two commodities are homogeneous, and it's not permissible to demand a compensation. Like the example you gave, let's say, rendering a service,
mm-hmm,
to the person who gave the good quality gold. Okay, that is also in the eye of Sharia. It's called a kind of addition. Addition. Okay?
Right.
Addition is not about only concrete things or solid things to be given to the person. It can be in the form of rendering a service. It, mm-hmm, it can be in the form of doing a job for someone. Okay?
Yeah.
All of these conditions, if placed in the contract, are haram and considered to be based on usury. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's considered to be usury. Okay?
I see.
And of course, usury, receiving it and giving it are forbidden, and it's considered a grave sin, to the extent that according to some hadiths, it is like committing incest in the Kaaba, in the house of Allah.
Shaykh Tawid, calling this transaction usually is one thing, ritually speaking or religiously speaking, but making it null and void is something else.
Yeah.
Do we cancel, or can we cancel this transaction based on the fact that this is usually pure and simple?
Well, what is forbidden is to carry out this transaction, okay? You cannot own the addition, the surplus amount or quantity of things that you exchange.
Somebody didn't know and the transaction went on. So they had the transaction, all,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And now the person is wise.
The person is still there, yes?
Both parties,
yes,
are alive. All right, and one of the parties just realized,
yes,
because of their contact with the religious scholars, now they got aware of the fact that that transaction that they had done like last year, for,
yes,
example, all right, that was a complete example of usury.
Good.
So what can he do? Can he go back to the other party and says, like, this is usury, I don't want to get involved in this, and then let's cancel the transaction. Is,
okay,
it possible to cancel the transaction based on the fact that it's usury?
It is permissible to cancel, okay? There's no problem about canceling the transaction, but, you know, there's also another alternative, and that is to return the addition.
Uh-huh.
That is the best solution.
I see.
Okay, you return the addition. Okay, if you have rendered a service, like the example we gave in the early part of this session, I think if you have rendered a service to compensate or,
mm-hmm,
to make up for the inferior quality, you can claim wages for that. Yeah,
right.
Claim wages for the services that you have. And
if the other party is not happy with it?
Okay, that means he has done a haram thing, okay?
Uh-huh.
Okay, he will have to pay for it. He has done a haram thing, and of course...
And you're acquitted.
Yeah, for the reason you have rendered a service, that's okay. You are not to blame, but he is to blame because he has stipulated.
I see.
The person who places a condition in the contract,
mm-hmm.
he is to blame, and of course... he has received the benefit of the service, okay?
Right?
And he is liable.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma inni as'aluka bi rahmatika
رحمتك التي وسعت كل شيء وبقوتك التي قهرت بها كل شيء وخضع لها كل شيء.
Dear brothers and sisters, in the previous programs we were talking about the beginning part of this dua, اللهم إني أسألك برحمتك التي وسعت كل شيء, and to understand this enormous and this embracing mercy of the Almighty Allah, we try to have a closer look at the creation. And in this way, maybe we can try to absorb some rays of Almighty Allah's knowledge. As it was concluded in the previous program, the creation of the atoms, what atoms created, and the world actually, the vastness of the world is beyond our understanding. For example, light itself has an incredible rapid speed of 300,000 kilometers per second. Anyway, this great system is only a corner of the living world, which is observed by man's limited knowledge. Only Allah is aware of the whole world and what is beyond the reach of human being. As Imam Ali alayhi salam has insightfully stated, creation is within Almighty Allah's mercy, the mercy that established and developed the world. Now, after that, having created the world and providing the necessary equipment and sustenance, the omnipotent will to create a notable being composed of body, soul, mind, heart and temper out of his mercy. And he placed man as his khalifa on earth. He placed him to grow, to gain strength by the blessing he has supplied, to live in accord with the guidance of the prophets and their books, and to worship the Creator and serve his fellow creatures. The man is transferred to the hereafter by death after that and is granted his recompense in the eternal paradise, remaining in the Almighty Allah's mercy forever. Now, we review some of the Almighty Allah's mercy embracing human, apparent and interior sides. Now, as you may be aware, the Holy Quran has considered the creation of human fetus as happening in stages. وَقَدْ خَلَقَكُمْ أَطْوَارًا, when he created you by diverse stages.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny. Oh Allah, I beseech you by your mercy, which encompasses everything, and by your power, by which you overcome everything, and which submits to it everything, and humble before it is everything. And by your might, by which you conquer everything, and by your majesty, against which nothing can stand, and by your greatness, which prevails over everything, and by your authority, which is exercised over everything, and by your own self that shall endure forever after everything has vanished, and by your names which manifest your power over everything, and by your knowledge which pervades everything, and by the light of your face which illuminates everything,
Now, we will try to have a closer look at these stages to fully understand the Almighty Allah's mercy in the creation of human being as well. At first, the Holy Quran says, وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنْ سُلَالَةٍ مِنْ طِينٍ. We created man out of an extraction of clay. The human embryo is a product of various foods coming from animals and plants. The plants feed the animals and are fed by the soul, and as a result, human embryo is also made from the earth. The latest scientific findings prove that the chemical elements found in the earth, such as iron, copper, calcium, and etc., exist in human body as well. Humans constantly obtain the extracts of chemicals present in the earth by feeding from animals and plants, and then reproducing. In the second stage, the Holy Quran states, وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرٌ. Then he is the one who created man from water. To biologists, human body resembles a sponge soaked in water. The body of a 70-kilogram person is composed of 50 liters of water, and this ratio is fixed for all people. If a person loses 20% of his body water, he will not recuperate again. Now, this water that is inside human cells completely lacks salt. The water outside the cells, on the other hand, has considerable salt. The composition of water outside the cell is just exactly the same as that of the water wherein the first living beings resided millions of years ago. Later on, when the water beings came to land, they practically carried the water they lived in, since they could not continue life without it. And this is the miracle of Holy Quran, which 14 decades ago, in an illiterate desert society, without scientific tools, stated, it is he who created man from water. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. We will, inshallah, continue with the stages of creation of human beings in the later programs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
To swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles. I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, The metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal.
Part 3.
At the start of the 20th century, the North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons, like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons. All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites. In order to help the fishermen, the Royal Danish Navy mission is to decontaminate ships polluted by gas. A bomb disposal unit is permanently ready to intervene in the zone.
On our ChemSea program, the search and assessment of chemical weapons, we investigated the codfish in munition sites and outside munition sites. In the munition sites, we actually found tumors in the codfish, stress on their kidneys and livers, extraprudential fish diseases. But the most alarming thing we found were the juvenile fish, their inability to reproduce. We're actually investigating Bellhorn now. We're taking fish samples, and some of these samples we have found are positive.
So if you expose the mussels to these compounds, they take it up, and they take it up in relation to the concentration you expose them to, and they show even on the lower concentration, on the lowest concentration, they show already effects. There's one thing though, to investigate how many or how high the concentration of a compound deriving from a warfare agent is in the organism you intend to consume, for example, so in the flesh of the fish or in the entire muscles. That's one thing, and you can debate about any limits now, which are allowed and which are maybe not really harming the consumer or not. However, there is, for me personally, there's only a general question. Do we accept that there are traces of damned ammunitions made to kill humans in your food?
What we know from the sediments and the water is that in all areas where munitions was dumped, you can find the substances leaking from the corroding munitions in the sediment and also in the deep waters. So there is a risk, really, that marine life takes up the substances in their natural habitat. After having studied this issue now for many years, we consider this to be a real ecological time bomb.
How do you explain that Germany and Belgium, with poor military budgets, have been working on solutions since 1980, while France is doing nothing? Domestic defense has the vast sum of 34.2 billion euros at its disposal, the equivalent of the Russian army, the second military force on the planet. Postponed until later. France has been doing that for over 20 years. Thus, the French chemical weapons were first of all stored in open air in a field in Vimy, in the Pas de Calais, regardless of the minimal security rules of the local population. But accidents, explosions, and leaks of toxic substances put pressure on army ministries to move the ammunition at the discretion of a military site. The shells were moved to the Suippes base in Ulpe. This camp had already housed part of the nuclear strike force. It was in the Pluton silos of the Hades missiles, as in the gods of hell in Greek mythology, where they were stored. The French army were the only ones not to give me authorization to film, and I couldn't film the camp. But 10 years ago, I'd filmed the same kind of half-buried silos in the north of the U.S. One century after the end of World War I, historic ammunition is rotting in the alveoli of old nuclear sites. It raises questions on the future of ammunition manufactured by the Directorate General of Armaments, because if France is incapable, for solely political reasons, of taking charge of 100-year-old weapons, what has it done with its obsolete major nuclear arsenal? France's chosen technology to destroy its land-based chemical arsenal will be operated by a dismantling program called Sequoia. Sequoia is not a new witticism from Michel Sapin. It's a military factory under construction in Ulpe that I was not authorized to film. These refusals emanate from one of France's most opaque structures, the Director General of Armaments. The DGA entrusted construction to an industrial military group that was rapidly sued for insider influence and bribery. The Sequoia project, 20 years after its launch, is still not operational. To put a stop to submerging this ammunition in the sea, the Belgian army built a dismantling center at Poelcapelle, in operation for over 20 years, despite a restricted military budget. Bomb disposal experts deal with shells from Flanders fields daily. The center has a solution for treating the abundant land-based ammunition. Could it take charge of the 35,000 tons of weapons submerged at Naka?
At this moment in Poelcapelle, every day munition, chemical munition from Flanders fields is brought in. What if you come up with thousands, tens of thousands of shells at the same time from the Paardenmarkt site that are corroding all of a sudden very fast because you put them in the air, so there's a lot of oxygen around?
I strongly believe that if we don't clean up the munitions, the ocean will die. It's just a matter of time. What we need to do now is we need to develop an international treaty, an international trust fund to address the site. We can clean this up.
My investigation leads me back to Germany, where it all began. Munsterkamp, an epicenter of the German chemical program during World War I and World War II, is located in the heart of a dense forest and still heavily contaminated. In the early 20th century, this camp was pioneering in the design of chemical weapons. Today, it is the European leader in decontamination techniques. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons uses German know-how to destroy mustard gas, chlorine, and the sarin gas. Perhaps one day, this center will destroy the ammunition that is submerged close to the German North Sea and Baltic coasts. For the moment, the solutions mostly concern weapons found on the ground. The issue of submerged ammunition and the damage it causes is still pending.
What we need to do is remove this from the military and establish civilian authority boards that can manage a cleanup, manage a solution to doing something about these munitions. As long as the military has them, they will determine, do I buy a tank, a plane, or a ship, or do I clean up a munition site? What do you think the answer is?
Since 1997 in Germany, a public company is responsible for dismantling and decontaminating on behalf of the Federal Ministry of Defense. The metallic residue that survives the destruction of the chemical elements is reduced to scrap and poured into containers. These small pieces of metal will be recycled for undercarriages for children's bikes, or will perhaps be turned back into shells for the tanks that I can hear in training. Years ago, the North Sea didn't exist, and a vast forest connected France to England. At the end of my filming, I met a Dutch fisherman who pulls out mammoth bones in his net, mixed with shells from both world wars. This discovery made me realize the lifespan of our population, these traces that we leave behind. These fossils came from a time when the North Sea didn't exist, while chemical weapons will probably poison the sea for centuries to come. What will remain of our civilization other than this waste? The sea is a world where everything is murky. Even our past becomes an oversight there. The dumping sites were forgotten willingly or through negligence. Even if oversight represents the biggest danger, today the sea where life came from is threatened by a time bomb that may destroy the fundamental things that populate it.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like